I'm John Perry, and this is Selected Prose.
Hey, all. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Selected Prose. It is November 19th, and America's going into another lockdown, so that'll be fun for everybody, I'm sure. Try to occupy your time with something, you know, listening to Selected Prose podcast, you know, interviews, listening to Selected Prose reading series, emailing Selected Prose and telling them what you want to hear next, all sorts of stuff like that. It'll help pass the time. It's been a good week for the podcast for a couple reasons. Reason one being I now have a co-host. Her name is Liz Eyre. She is a friend of mine and a classmate at the NYU Creative Writing Program, where we are both striving to get our MFA. She's a phenomenal writer. She's a wonderful person, very smart, extremely well-read. I know we're going to have some great discussions down the line. And, you know, we had our first last week with Elle Nash. We spoke to Elle about her novel, Animals Eat Each Other. That novel was featured in the Oprah magazine back in 2018, and Publishers Weekly hailed it as a complex, impressive exploration of obsession and desire. It is certainly that. It's a lot more. We get into it. We get into a lot of other things. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about some of her other work. Elle has a small collection of stories coming out in 2021 titled Nudes. Keep your eyes peeled. Her short stories and essays have appeared in Guernica, The Nervous Breakdown, Lit Hub, Volume 1 Brooklyn, New York Tyrant, and elsewhere. She's also the founding editor of Witchcraft Magazine, and she's a fiction editor at Hobart Pulp. She also teaches writing workshops, and will be hosting a new one in the near future. It's called Knife Party. It's going to teach you how to become a better self-editor. Knife Party will last from December 1st through December 12th. Sign up now. Enrollment is open. You can email her at lnash@gmail.com, but lnash this time with a G. So it's ellegnash@gmail. So make sure you get in on that before it fills up. It will totally be worth your time. Elle took us to school in this interview. I learned a lot. My writing will be better for it. So will yours. So let's say hi to Liz and get on with it. So where are you right now, Liz? Are you at home?
I'm at home in my apartment in Greenwich Village, sort of close to NYU.
You got some plants?
Yeah. You've probably seen over the course of our class through the MFA program that I've been acquiring more plants and putting them in my background.
That's great. You gotta have plant. Oh yeah, this one in the windowsill too.
Yeah, it was dying in the bedroom, so I brought it over there.
Get some sunlight, yeah. I'm in my apartment here, in my bedroom. In Brooklyn. There's a windstorm happening right now.
Really? That's weird that you have a windstorm happening and I don't.
Yeah, I don't understand it at all. But on my weather app, it was like warning, you know, powerful gusts.
I wonder what mine says.
Which, in terms of like threats, like wind is really low on my radar.
Yeah, I mean it does seem low, but at the same time, we should probably be concerned about wind.
Yeah, yeah. But
it'd be dangerous.
I don't know about Brooklyn wind, you know? Brooklyn wind. The more concerning thing is like my our apartment building is seemingly collapsing.
Slowly. That sounds bad.
Yeah, the landings on the stairwells are like becoming cracked because of they're like separating. It's a lot of fun. I'm basically just waiting until I collapse from the fifth floor to my death.
Or get blown away or something.
One or the other. It's such a dangerous city.
You gotta be careful in New York.
Yeah.
It's really windy.
It's so windy. Gosh, I gotta get out of here. But yeah.
You know, thank you for having me on the podcast and for inviting me to come on. And I really like what you've been up to. And cool. I'm so excited to, you know, interview more writers and try to, you know, for myself and my own personal curiosity, but also so that people listening can, you know, have this resource to support their own writing practices.
Yeah, no, it's like great to have you, and I completely agree. I don't know, I just got to remember we were like sitting somewhere, I guess the writer's house.
We were sitting in the writer's house.
Yeah. And you were just like listing off authors. And I guess, what would you describe it as? Not like alt lit. I don't know if I like understand what that means, that term, but like almost like a Hobart school of writer. I don't know what I'm saying, but there's like an underground sort of movement of writers like that we particularly enjoy, like Elle and Sam Pink and Bud Smith. And then I was like, hell yeah, you know, let's just make this a co-host thing.
I so appreciate you setting up this whole thing, because I would love to do a podcast, I always thought, but I would never, ever take the initiative to start one or to, you know, even ask to be on one, but I did, kind of mutual.
You were like, I'd love to help out, and I was like, I would love for you to be co-host. So that's kind of how
I was like, that sounds great. Yeah, that's exactly what I was angling for.
Yeah, it's perfect. It worked out perfectly. But yeah, no, it'll be good to like steal the valuable lessons that we're learning from our professors at NYU and give them to listeners and get people excited about writing or whatever it is. Storytelling shows up everywhere. It's not just like for writing or you know, I'm thinking like lawyers. My friend the other day, he's an attorney, and he was like, oh, I could get you to write the facts section of my legal brief because you got to tell a good story. So it's useful for everyone. But
my mom keeps being like, oh, you're getting your MFA, that's great, like people need writers for everything, like you could write on a website, you could write like product descriptions, or you could write letters.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It's funny. It's also funny how people just, hey, you have this creative passion, it'd be really cool, you could go write copy for ExxonMobil. It's like, or, you know, you could somehow squeeze a profession.
Advertising.
Yeah, exactly. So don't do that, everyone. You don't have to do that. But if you want to tell stories of any type, hopefully we can be of service.
Or I imagine we also have some great, you know, some readers that might want to just listen to these. There's so many amazing writers that, you know, you've interviewed already, and hopefully we're going to have some more. And it's interesting because I've been watching all these interviews with musicians recently on YouTube and whatever, just like quarantine hobbies. And
yeah,
there's so few with writers, and especially with contemporary writers, there's so much interesting work that's being done, and we obviously get to read it, but it's kind of nice to have more informal discussions and conversations with these people that are doing really interesting work.
So we're bringing Elle Nash to the people.
Yeah.
She's super cool. Like, just outside of how great her writing is, and how like dark and inventive and ballsy it is.
Yeah. It's and like a great felt and
yeah,
and really well articulated. And I feel like there's such a, when we spoke with her, she was talking about starting writing from a feeling place, you know, and listening to songs and trying to conjure just like deep feelings or nostalgic feelings or whatever. And I feel like you can really sense that reading her work. Like, it's so evocative, for lack of a better word. It really takes the reader to a deep space of feeling.
It absolutely does. And it reminds me of what she said about like establishing mood, which I thought was very interesting, which is like not only like fixing or cutting out the boring parts of a piece, but like sentences not being or ever feeling like stage direction, but being twisted to fit the mood that she's trying to cultivate. Like, it was just kind of like an interesting way where she just like needs sentences over and over again until it works. And I appreciated like the labor that I think she maybe, I don't know if she like shortchanged herself or was being humble or whatever, but I mean, you can tell she worked on this book for 5 years.
Yeah.
Like, it's just very intricate and like, there's a lot there. There's a lot to unpack.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really admirable. And also without, you know, as she mentioned, ever doing her MFA or anything like that. Although, you know, taking certain courses and.
Yeah. And it seems like workshops, it seems like she really enjoys the process of being involved in like local workshops too, which I think when the death virus is over is an option that people can really consider. It's easy to do and it's just like anyone can do it. And there are so many unique perspectives that like, you know, you can get from it and that she clearly has gotten from it and she's found mentors and everything.
Yeah. I think that that's like something, it's pretty interesting thinking about workshops and how valuable they are, because I feel like there's a certain amount of, I'm not sure what the word is, but like disdain is too strong a word, but it's like, I often feel like writers don't want to talk about how workshops have helped them. Like everybody's so quick to be like, oh, workshop, like don't take anybody else's opinion. And mm-hmm. it's just a waste of time. And like, it's just good to have a deadline, but like nobody's going to help you on your writing but yourself and, you know, whatever. And the truth is like, I've loved pretty much every workshop I've ever been in. Obviously there have been annoying people who suck, you know, but like, but even those people, they brought something special. And so I don't know. I think like part of the thing with this podcast and sharing our experiences as MFA students, it's like, I almost feel a little embarrassed to be getting my MFA, but at the same time, I totally love it. I'm learning so much.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like, you know, to any other writers listening, it's like workshops are great. Listening to other writers is great. And I think that, you know, because writing is so solitary, it's so nice to have community in whatever form it manifests, you know, whether that's online or in a workshop or, you know, listening to interviews or whatever.
And I think it's like good for your work too. I mean, I'm sure, I know. Like, yeah, it's a solitary profession and we've got the whole like tortured, lonely
mm-hmm.
writer image, but it's very inspiring to like be surrounded by people who are doing weird, strange, unique things you'd never think to do. Which you wouldn't have heard about them otherwise, probably. I mean, unless you're reading like small internet lit mags, which I don't know how many of us are doing.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's like a lot of cool energy and like things are changing. And there's been this pattern in the last like 3 or 4 interviews, just about how like we deal with like writing about the internet
mm-hmm.
and like how to like navigate that and stuff. And, you know, we're like the community is cracking the code slowly.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. But no, I completely agree. I kind of like wince a little bit about the MFA too. And I don't know why.
It's embarrassing for some reason. Like it's just like.
It's because all the damn articles that have been written about like, is it worth it and blah, 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 you know?
I know.
George Saunders says it's worth it, so whatever.
I say it's worth it. I like it.
I feel that it's like entirely worth it. I'm like, who's complaining about this?
I think it's just people that are trying to get into MFA programs, keeping other people from applying because it's a great deal. It's really, really helpful and really interesting. And even if you don't learn anything, I mean, like to just be in a program with a bunch of people that want to write is fucking weird.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, it is weird. No one like admits that, you know, it's like at the grocery store and
mm-hmm.
like, I've always wanted to be a writer.
That happens to me sometimes with people, but the grocery store, but strangers are always talking to me.
Oh, so. That's a good like trait to have.
It's all right.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so Elle taught us a lot. What else? Anything else?
I don't think so.
All right, well, let's get Elle in here.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey.
Good, how are you?
Good, it's nice to meet you.
Yeah, how are you doing today?
I'm good. I'm a little bit tired, but I can't complain. So
where are you zooming in from?
Colorado Springs currently. Okay. Yeah.
So, cool.
How about you two?
We're both in New York. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Yeah. We're both in the NYU MFA program. That's how we met, and sort of like the, I guess, underpinning for this podcast is like meeting writers and talking about writing and kind of like giving people almost like something to do with like MFA content who aren't necessarily doing an MFA, or, you know, just like writing material and inspiration.
Cool. I love that. I am all for resources that can help writers like outside of the academic world. So that's really cool.
Yeah, we get all these like interesting lessons and stuff in class, and we figured more people than us deserve to hear it. And we both read Animals Eat Each Other this week.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm also really like excited you guys asked me to come on the podcast. So I haven't done a podcast in a while, so I'm almost like, I feel a little rusty, like a little nervous. So
if it helps, we're both noobs. So
yeah, this is my first time doing it. John just asked me to do it. Well, I kind of volunteered. I was like, your podcast sounds really cool. Can I come on it?
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, kind of want to talk about the book, but just hear how you're doing first and what you're working on, what you got coming up.
Sure. I'm doing good. I mean, I think my mantra this year has been like, it could always be worse, you know? But this year I finished up two manuscripts that I was working on. One is a short story collection, and then another is a full-length novel, and I just finished those in October. And it's honestly like, I almost feel like I'm like, yeah, I'm gonna take like a little bit of a break from writing for a while, which feels weird to say because I feel like I've been so gung-ho for the last couple years, like writing almost every day, you know. So but it's been good, and I'm glad to like finish some big projects and kind of like look towards the future. So
have you been writing at all? Like, we have sort of been asking people like how writing during COVID is going, because obviously, you know, we all have all this time, but then it's a super stressful, insane time to be writing. So have you been writing recently or found that challenging?
Yeah. So I think at first I did feel a little bit like, oh, extra time to write. And then through the summer, it got a little bit difficult to like get motivated. But then I kind of like hit this point where writing kind of became like my like escapism. So it was like all I was doing, you know. I was just kind of like obsessed with just trying to work on it and finish my project. And it was like just how I was getting out of the stress of the world and stuff. But then, I think I just hit this point where I feel a little bit burnt out, and I think my brain does kind of need a break. So I'm like deliberately trying to like take a break from creative projects, which feels hard because like, I don't think I do well when I don't have something to work on. So I'm kind of like trying not to like overwork myself. Like, I'm like, no, you have to enjoy life, like go on walks, you know, like go outside in the sun before it gets too cold, that kind of thing. So
that's cool. Are you doing other projects or other creative things other than writing?
So I run a literary magazine, so right now I'm like reading through submissions and that kind of thing, and then just like teach a workshop, which I guess it's writing related still, but it's like not directly writer related. And then, you know, sometimes I like to like paint or draw, but I have a toddler, so it's really hard to do that kind of stuff when she's awake, because she just like, it's fun to paint with her and that kind of thing, but she definitely, you can't do anything that's very like intentional, because she wants to do it with you and all that stuff. You know what I mean? So it's one of those things where like, you just kind of have to like balance it.
How's the teaching experience been?
It's been good. This is like the first year that I've really, like, I've taught online workshops in the past, but this is the first year where I started the 6-month workshop in January, and then I ran it again in July. So every month I'm doing new lessons and I'm doing feedback, which is kind of like, I don't know, I guess how teachers teach, like, you know what I mean? And like maybe MFA programs or something like that, like the length of it. And it's been really good. Like sometimes I find myself having a lot of self-doubt, but then other times I feel like I'm just like reading so much great work from people that it inspires me too, and it really forces me to think really critically about why I write what I write and what I'm writing and, you know, what the intention is behind it. Like I feel like I've also learned a lot from it. So it's been really good and I'm going to continue doing it. I really like having people to share like what I like about literature with. And I also really get a lot of joy out of editing work. Like I love like looking at a short story and trying to figure out what's not working and what does work, you know, kind of like a puzzle and stuff. I really do enjoy that aspect of teaching. So
it's funny because John and I were talking about your book and also about just like being in the MFA and how difficult it is sometimes to submit work that's really vulnerable or sexual or transgressive, because it's like we submit it to this group of people we don't really know. And, you know, it can feel kind of like risky, and there's also kind of a general atmosphere of like, you know, like that we shouldn't be submitting sex scenes, or that we shouldn't be submitting stuff that's kind of more, I guess, transgressive. And do you, I guess my question would be like, how do you create an atmosphere that's conducive to sharing that sort of work? Or is that important for you as a teacher to be cultivating like a framework in which people can submit more transgressive work?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I don't even have an MFA, you know, so I've never experienced like that environment, but I learned, I like studied under Tom Spanbauer for a couple of years, just like one-on-one mentorship. And like one of his like philosophical views on teaching is that sore and vulnerable place is like, for him, it's where all good writing comes from. And I think he really believes in fostering the kind of environment that allows people to have that story come through. And I feel really passionate about that also, like creating a space where people can explore those aspects of their work, and also like synthesize it into something that can render that, like those moments to truthfulness, I suppose, for other readers. Like he says this quote, and I can't remember who originally said it, that always is like, the job of the writer is to bring the reader to their knees. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of like, I always go into it of saying like, where if there's something that you're afraid of exploring, then it's probably a good idea to try to explore that. And I definitely like go into that like with my workshops, is try to encourage, you know, people to do that. And I haven't had any issues with that. I would never force someone to like write something that did scare them if they didn't want to write about it either. So,
well, one of the things Liz and I were talking about was just, I guess, like this term, we've already used it a couple times in this podcast, transgressive fiction. But we're both pretty interested in your relationship with and opinions of Dennis Cooper, because we know that we've seen your tweets and whatever. Yeah. Else, but I know Liz, you're a pretty big fan, and you're kind of showing me the ropes, but I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about that and like your views on this, I guess, transgressive fiction movement.
Yeah. God, that's like a broad question. I don't know what to say. So I actually had not read any Dennis Cooper until this year. I went out and I bought like 4 of his books. And I told myself I was going to like stay off the internet until I finished all of them. And I didn't do that. But I finished Closer, and I just finished Frisk. And like, I really feel almost speechless sometimes about his work, because he has this ability to take readers like really far into places that you wouldn't imagine you could take a reader, you know. Like Frisk was like really intense for a while, where I just said this today, where I almost was like questioning my own aesthetics, like literary choices as a reader. Like I was like this is like pretty far. But then when I finished the book, it was so like, I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but it was just like so like genius. Like it was brilliant the way that he like just wrapped up the plot, I guess. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, I read that book, well, a while, I don't even remember, my sense of time is so off, but Frisk is crazy. I remember reading it and feeling like I should be arrested for reading it. Like I should be in jail, like just for like witnessing it, which is pretty incredible to create that sense in the reader and to like push boundaries like so far, but also to do it in a way that is so literary for reasons I can't even really put my finger on, you know? Like, I don't know what it is that makes Dennis Cooper like so much, like such a truly, I don't know, literary writer, but yeah. Are there other like transgressive writers that you like or would recommend to people or things that have inspired you in kind of pushing boundaries in your work?
I would have to say, okay, so one recent author that I do really enjoy is B.R. Yeager. He wrote Amygdala Tropolis, which is kind of like it explores just 4chan and that kind of thing, which when I read it, I was like really impressed. It was one of those books that for me, I was like, you know, when you read a novel and like it opens up your idea of like what a novel can be. I mm-hmm. always really love that world opening feeling of coming across something new. Mm-hmm. And then I read his book Negative Space, which was really, really good. Like I definitely see, like I just hope he like keeps writing because I feel like I can see him being like super like cult hit type of author.
Yeah. I just reached for it. I just grabbed it. I read it the other week. It was incredible. I mean, there's something really interesting about the way that he like infuses the internet into his storytelling in a way that doesn't feel forced. And you kind of do that too. Like you just published a new story in Guernica, right? It's Cat World. And like it's the fundamental, it kind of circles around a chat between two users on the internet. So how do you like approach writing about the internet? And I don't know, when I do it, it seems hard. I feel weird when I'm like, hey, she tweeted or whatever. I don't know how to fit it in there without it sounding odd.
If somebody was just tweeting, hey.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I guess like that's a really good question. Like form wise, you know, I think part of it has to do with like understanding the pacing of your story and including only the details I think that matter to like push that plot forward about it, about the particular story. Oh, that's like a really tough question. It's kind of like, I think it has a lot to do with pacing. I think that has to be the big thing because mm-hmm. when you're reading something that is definitely like you have text messages and stuff like that going back and forth, you have to be really careful that if you include it too much, then the reader can get like bogged down by the repeated cadence, right? Mm-hmm. Of how stuff looks on the internet. So you definitely have to, I think, balance it with like real world stuff, you know, like detail and like, I don't know. It's like such a good question with that kind of thing. I think it definitely comes down to like pacing though, for sure.
Do you feel like it's, cause I read that story that you just published and it felt like so necessary for the internet to be a part of it. I mean, it's such a, you know, an important central theme to the story. And like, do you feel like you're drawn more personally to writing about the internet? Like, do you, because for me, I'm like, I don't even know if I could write without the internet in what I'm writing, because it's such a huge part of my consciousness and world. And yeah, just like personally, do you feel drawn to writing about the internet?
Yeah, I think I do. I don't think like I intended to set out thinking I would write about it, but like, you know, I think for a lot of us, we've been on the internet since we were really young and it's just a huge part of my life. Like I've always had online friends, like long distance friends, people I've never even met that I'm still friends with, you know, and I've always expressed myself using the internet. So I just think naturally it's going to be a part of our world. You know, and it is part of our world. I mean, mm-hmm. it's a real world. It's not just that it's a virtual or not real world anymore. It very much is like our world, you mm-hmm. know?
Yeah. Especially for writers. I mean, do you feel like the internet helps? Like, I know like I spend way too much time online and it distracts from my writing in just like a you know, in that I'm like addicted to the internet kind of way, but like, do you feel like it hurts your writing? And I know you're kind of taking a break right now, but is it distracting for you?
Yeah, it definitely is. Like, I think what I really miss is I miss the internet before social media, you know, like before like big social media, you know. I think like spaces like LiveJournal weren't really that bad because it was still very much focused on sharing and not about creating like dopamine feedback loop. Mm-hmm. Whereas like with our smartphones and stuff, it's accessible all the time. And I think there's something about holding it in your hand that like humans are basically wired to use tools and use tools as extensions of our bodies, you know, like biologically, like speaking. And I just think that when you have it in your hand, you know, there's just something that happens with our brains that encourages it to just be really interested in it and consider it like so deeply part of us. And I think that's what makes it distracting. Mm-hmm. I also think that like before social media got really big, we had like this kind of wild free open internet. Like people were like, I don't even remember how I found websites before Google. And it's like, yeah, like we used to have that, like this vast array of like a world we could experience. And now, you know, I kind of think of it like in the sense that you had this like wild environment that you could go explore, you know, like you'd hitch a wagon to your horse and just like walk through the internet and find all this shit. And now it's kind of like, because we have Facebook, because we have Twitter, we all go to like one place and like we just hang out and like get all our information and all of our fun and all of our interaction there. And it's almost like we kind of like live in this like walled garden. And I don't like that feeling. Like when I use Twitter a lot, my brain starts to feel like really tired and I'm just like, no, I want to like get out of the walled garden. Like I want to explore like life again. And, you know, and there was so much good about the internet, like that had, that I feel is really hard to find now.
It's so true. It's so crazy how many like great minds are on Twitter and like just like kind of corralled into this like certain number of characters and having to press like the like button. And it's like, I feel like it's such a prison. Mm-hmm.
Do you guys remember StumbleUpon?
Oh yeah.
You just reminded me of StumbleUpon, which is like it was exactly how it sounded. It was this website where you would click, you'd click stumble and you would stumble through the garden of the internet and it would bring up like a website about flowers. And then it would be like, you'd stumble again and it would bring up a news website. And it was like very adventurous way to use the web. Whereas you're so right. Yeah. Now we're kind of, and even when we're on Twitter, we're sort of like targeted with the next idea. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of hard to, I don't know. The magic might somehow be gone a little bit.
Yeah. I miss chat roulette. Like I've been so surprised that chat roulette isn't having a crazy renaissance right now with COVID. Like we're all on our computers and like, can we all just get back on chat roulette and have like some good clean fun?
Yeah.
Like saying hi, but.
I'm trying to think of like really old websites. Remember when like flash cartoons were huge? Like, that dude who did the frog in a blender thing, Joe Cartoon or something. Do you remember that? That's way old. There were like all these websites of people who did like, I guess you could even say it's very early internet transgression because mm-hmm. it was actually before like, I mean, it was the stuff that existed on the fringes, like before even places like 4chan and stuff were around. Just because people were like, yeah, like it's a cartoon. We're gonna do violent things with cartoons. And when I was a teenager, I was like, this is so edgy. Like
yeah, newgrounds.com and this is so nostalgic all of a sudden.
I remember
Salad Fingers.
Oh yeah, Salad Fingers. Oh man, that one was really good.
Jesus.
Yeah. And then is E-bombs World even still around? I don't even know.
I remember that as well.
That's funny to think of like Salad Fingers as like an early influence on like our creative development.
Yeah. Well, okay, so animals eat each other.
Yes.
It was a phenomenal read for both of us. We have a lot of questions. I kind of just want to know if you could tell us a little bit about like what it is and where it came from.
Sure. It's a book. It's like actually, oh my god, I read this thing by Nell Zink recently that was really funny, where she was like, how to be a novelist. And one of the tips was like, sarcastically, it was like beautiful. It was like, write a novella, put everything in it, like everything terrible and beautiful, and then don't publish it. And I was like, fuck. But basically, like, I had started writing this story in a workshop that I was in, and it's actually what I started workshopping with Tom Spanbauer when he was still teaching and stuff. And as we were working on it, when I was revising it, he basically was like, well, what about this? And like, what about all these things? And it just kept growing and growing until eventually I was like, oh, okay, so this is actually like a book story. This isn't just like a short story, you know? So that's what I kept doing. I just kept expanding and exploring it as much as I could. And then it just became a novella. It kind of came out of what it was like to live in Colorado Springs in the early to mid 2000s, being like a child of nu metal and living in a pretty like evangelical type of town, you know. Like Colorado Springs is kind of unique because we have like 5 military bases, and so people really come and go, and it feels a bit like a purgatory when you're growing up here, when everyone's coming and going and you don't really see a lot of opportunity. And there's a lot of drug use, like, there was like in the high schools and stuff like that. And I really just wanted to explore like what that kind of life was like, you know, when someone struggles and then they don't necessarily change towards the end, because that's, you know, true to reality. You know, it takes a long time for people to change, and sometimes they never do. So
how old were you when you wrote it?
I think I started writing it in 2014. So that's 6 years ago. Hang on, how old am I? So I was 26 or 27 when I started writing it. And I'm 33 now, so.
Cool. Because the narrator in the book is like 18, right? Or quite young, right? Yeah.
It's like 18 to 19, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that there's like, because I noticed in the story that you just published in Guernica, like the narrator, the main character is young as well. Is there something towards like looking back to earlier parts of your life or earlier, you know, time frames in your life that is conducive to writing for you?
Well, that's a good question. I think I like to write about the teenage experience because it's so easily dismissed in the real world. Like, I just remember being a teenage girl and like nobody taking my feelings seriously. And I see that now, even like adults and stuff like that. Like my generation of people will say, like, I have friends who are like, I'm afraid of teenagers. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, we were teenagers not even that long ago, you know? Or I see people who kind of dismiss their lives and their struggles and the things they're interested in as not very serious because they're so young. And so I think that's why I like to focus on the teenage experience, because in my life at those times, the problems that I was facing, they felt serious, and they still were, you know. Those experiences form us and mold us into how we are later in life. And I just think it's important to look at those experiences.
Yeah, totally. I remember like when I was reading your book, there was a point where I was like, this character seems too wise and mature in this section and for her age. And then I was like, actually, no, like that's what I was like when I was that age. And that's what so many teenage girls are like. And it really is dismissed, like the perspective of young people and also like the amazing intensity of that time in our development. Like everything feels so much more alive and, you know, I don't know, so much more intense. And so it's a really interesting time to write about.
Yeah, I know, like when I look back on some of my old journals, like I feel like I forget so much about my early life, but when I look back on my journals, sometimes I have these moments where I'm like, oh dude, you were like really fucking smart, like I can't believe you wrote this. But then sometimes I look back and I'm just like, this is like the most basic bitch shit ever. Like, just in terms of like the complexity of my language and like my thoughts and feelings in terms of like how I experience them. But it's like, you know, it's kind of like, it's a bit of both, you know. Humans are complex, and we're always complex and multifaceted, you know. So yeah. And I've also definitely even like met younger people, like, because I've worked retail a lot, so I definitely I'm usually around a lot of younger people, and I met younger people where I'm just like, god damn, like, you really have your shit together. And I don't remember being that mature when I was that age. Like, it's pretty cool to see that, you know. So it's definitely not something to dismiss. I think
I started journaling 2 days ago as a 29-year-old. But we were talking about I guess, like, the process. We currently have a professor who's speaks pretty highly about journaling, but now that you've told us that's a habit that you have had your whole life, how did it play a part in drafting Animals Eat Each Other? Were you referring to old journals, or did it kind of just come from memory? Or,
you know, mostly it came from memory. Gosh, when I think about the process of it, I basically, like, sat down and I would think about the feelings that I had, you know, just at, like, any kind of feeling, like feelings of alienation or feelings of rejection or that sort of feelings of heartbreak and that sort of thing. And it would just kind of, like, create this sort of atmosphere inside of my head. And so, like, I would just, like, sit inside of that atmosphere and really think about what it would take to create that atmosphere in someone else. And I hate that that sounds so, like, you know, woo-woo or, like, ethereal or whatever, but for a long time, like, I couldn't even write if I knew people were home because it would be so distracting. And then I would end up listening to, like, the same songs on repeat for a long time to, like, pull back that emotional atmosphere. And that was, like, that was a big part of the process for me, which I think is something I still explore, is atmosphere. Because when I read work that where I feel emotionally moved, it's usually, it's the same thing where I can tell they're creating, like, a mood or a tone inside of me. And that's maybe it's like a nostalgic type of thing. Like, you know, when you feel nostalgia, it's kind of like that type of thing. Like, you sometimes you even miss experiences or moments you've never even had. And so that's the kind of, like, experience I think I'm always going for.
I mean, I'm always looking for that underlying feeling. That's why I read. And things can be really boring sometimes, or, like, lack that intensity, you know?
Yeah. Like, one thing I learned from Tom a lot was really working to eliminate what he called, like, reported text or, like, reported lines, you know, where it's basically just, you're basically, like, telling characters, like, what to do on a page, rather than, you know, kind of fucking with the sentence to, like, yeah, create that mood.
Yeah. John and I were discussing, like, writing from life, like, writing from one's own life, and how to transfigure that in a way. Like, we were talking about writing autofiction and how every work of autofiction needs to have kind of an underlying cosmology or you know, worldview underpinning it to be its own concrete work. And so I was just wondering if you sort of thought about that in writing your book, and also, like, structurally how you organized it, like, within the sections. I mean, it's kind of a big question, but I guess it's more of, like, a structural question.
So when you're saying, like, cosmology, do you mean, like the relationship between the reader and the writer? Like, how, if it's autofiction, the reader is kind of like, oh, this is a person kind of writing about their own lives, and it kind of plays with that reality a bit?
I was thinking, like, you know, in writing about one's own life, like, it's like I could write stories from my own life, and if I don't have some kind of almost, like, thematic underpinning to it, it's just sort of, like, kind of narcissistic, or, like, you know, that there isn't, like, it's not functioning as a work as a whole.
Yeah.
Yeah, it reads almost, I mean, it reads almost more as, like, a journal entry or something, as opposed to a work of fiction. Okay. If people fail to establish what Liz is talking about.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I totally get what you mean. Yeah. Yeah, I get what you're saying, because you need to, like, pull everything together. And sometimes, like, because life isn't neat, you don't have, like, a good, like, plot or something like that. That is a really good question. So, like, my answer to this may not be very good, but I guess, like, I've never thought about trying to stay true to like a story or something like that. Like, I've always kind of messed around with it, you know, to do that. So I do have to say, actually, so when I first wrote animals, I didn't plan it or anything like that. I was just like kind of expanding and expanding and expanding it. And it definitely was like one of those things where I had to fuck around with like the scenes and the elements and stuff like that. Like, I didn't get my MFA, so I wasn't even going into it having a concrete definition of real elements of fiction, you know, like a plot and structure and all that stuff. Like, I didn't even really, like, I think everyone knows the basic structure of a plot, but they don't know it until, like, they see it, you know what I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. I didn't really know any of that. And then when I went into working on my next manuscript, I actually thought, like, I'm gonna try to plan it and, like, learn about some of those more concrete elements of fiction and see how that goes. And that actually helped me a lot in terms of thinking about what scenes to put where and how to actually structure a story and not really worry about what it means to stay true, quote unquote, to the story. You know, like, I guess it was like staying true to the story means what keeps the reader reading, like what keeps them in that dream state of staying in your fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's cool. That's so cool that you didn't, you know, that you were just working intuitively essentially and like just figuring it out, and not, you know, working with a rule book or, you know, terms that were, or points you're supposed to hit.
Yeah.
I did feel lost though. And once I was able to plan, I feel like I got done so much better. Like, I kind of was like, wow, I don't know why I didn't do this before. But that's only because, like, I had a baby, so I was, like, really strapped for time. I felt like I didn't have, like, the same amount of time to just, like, fuck around as I used to. Mm-hmm. So.
So some comment. Yeah, Liz and I are generally anti-planning. That's what we were talking about yesterday. Just kind of go with the flow, but maybe it's good to stop along the way and get your shit together.
Yeah, like, so, I mean, for stories and stuff, I never plan them. I definitely just, like, work those like through from beginning to end, whatever they are. But like with when I wanted to like write this full-length novel, I had tried a couple different manuscripts and I kept stalling out. And I think that's why, is that I was like, why do I keep, like, I just don't know why I can't keep moving forward with these. So that's why I kind of was like, all right, I'm just gonna figure out some basics, you know, like try to just start from the ground up again and see what happens if I add a little structure. So
with animals, what did that look like exactly?
I literally just, I would just like read the work aloud. And then if there were places that there were like bump, like things that bumped you out of the story, you know, mm-hmm. or places where I felt like bored or something, I would just kind of look at them and figure out what needed to be changed. And then if there were moments that, if there was any moment of summary, like if there was ever a summary sentence, I would look at that and I would immediately just like unpack that into like a full scene. And I just kept doing that. Like I just kept going through the story and it was really like haphazard and back and forth. And like I had to like change some scenes around and there was like stuff that still felt like incomplete that I had to keep unpacking. And I did that for like 5 years. So it was like I felt like it was a long process, especially because the novel is so short. Mm-hmm.
I love that idea of taking a sentence where you're summarizing and then turning it into a scene. That's such a good tool. Yeah, good to, I'm like thinking of where I should do that right now when I'm writing.
Yeah, something I like that you said though is that like when you were reading your work over again, your gauge for it is kind of like, if it bored you personally. Sometimes I think I worry about, I don't know, like, is my class going to be bored by it? And the real question is like, how do you feel about it?
Yeah, I'm definitely like 100% about developing and trusting your own intuition and work. Especially because I think as writers, we spend like a fuck ton of time questioning ourselves and like being afraid of literally everyone else's opinion. Mm-hmm. But I think if like, I guess this is really important for me when I'm looking through work, to like just like you sit down and you read it and you have to like kind of listen to like what your voice inside is telling you, right? Like if you feel bored about a particular sentence, then it's probably boring. You know, like that is like a sign of dissatisfaction. And so if you're dissatisfied, then you have to change it. Like you are compelled to change it. And like one thing that I've really been thinking a lot about this year because of working on my novel manuscript is like excising laziness out of the novel. And it sounds like really harsh, but I just think like I've found a lot of moments too where I've been lazy in my work, and I don't want that, you know, because I think lazy work is work that you read that it could have been written by anybody. But when you sit down and like you really like drill into, like you remove all of that as much as you can, not cutting, but like transforming and adding more specificity and creating more detail and, you know, destructing the sentence so that it's, you know, more voicey in the way that you like it to be, like then that's a story that only like you could have written. And that's something that you would be, that hopefully you will be most satisfied with, even if you still hate it at the end of the day. You know,
in terms of what you were talking about with like, you know, writers worrying about how stuff comes off, like did you worry about that when you published your book? Because it's pretty ballsy. Like it's pretty like, I mean, it's awesome that you put it out there into the world. Like did you feel weird, like shame about it, or did you experience repercussions from people in your life about it?
That's a good question. I've had people ask me that a lot too. And sometimes I'm like, well, no, I didn't really even think about that. Like, but maybe that's just because like, I have a really distant relationship with my family, you know, like they're also not emotional and they don't talk about things. Mm-hmm. And so I think maybe internally or something, as I was writing and publishing stuff, I just thought like, I guess it doesn't even matter because if they had something to say about it, they would never say it. I don't know, you know, but yeah, I never thought about that really. I just, even though I'm someone who is very self-conscious usually, I think fiction is like the one world where like I do really feel like I can be free without worrying what other people think. And so over the years, I've definitely developed this mentality of like, no, this is my like place. And I really like, I cannot care like what people think about it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I do like care, you know, like sometimes I'll get feedback from friends and stuff and like on whether the writing is good, and it can be really wounding. But if I know too also that if I let that stuff get to me too much, then I wouldn't be able to move forward. Like I wouldn't be able to progress as a writer. And I guess I just feel so fervent about that, that I just like eventually like push it away.
I noticed in the acknowledgments to your book, because I, you know, just finished it the other day, you were like, thanks to my family for supporting my writing, even though they don't really get it. Like, yeah. Which I thought was funny. Yeah. Like, but yeah, that's interesting to hear that it isn't so much the, you know, worrying about the content that you're putting out there, but just worrying about whether, you know, whether it's good or not, or whether it speaks to people. Yeah, it does seem like that's a lot more important.
Yeah, I don't know why I've never had that like concern about what other people would think about it in terms of me. And maybe that's because like, I don't know, like it's a book, like I'm just I'm just like, if people were like, you know, fuck this book, I'm just like, okay, well, that's fine. I don't know.
It's just a book.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I would like to talk a little bit about like some of the characters in the book, and Liz and I were kind of fascinated by both Lilith and the undercurrent of Satanism. Yeah, just like it was like very interesting, very unexpected, very kind of it was a very raw, interesting take on like seemingly normal people. Like one of the characters' mom, Matt, is a tattoo artist and a functioning individual in society who has these like very intricate views of Satanism, and I would love to hear kind of where that came from.
Yeah, sure. I'm really fascinated in like all religions, but I'm particularly attracted to Satanism because I think that it is a response to like kind of Christian materialism in the United States. Like I think we have a really unique kind of Christianity, which is like, I would say different from maybe like Catholicism, for example, because we have evangelicalism and a huge Pentecostal following. And I guess one of my, I just have a personal affront with it, because I think that like Christianity in the mind, like in like the, I guess, American psyche, creates a lot of shame and a lot of low self-worth and a lot of it's just, I guess it's just really hard to describe. I'm not trying to like be mean to Christians or anything. I have no problem with Christians, like, per se. Like, I don't have a problem with people's personal beliefs. But I guess just my personal experience is that like it was like damaging to like my own self-worth. And even when I wasn't a Christian, and even when I was exploring other religions, I still found like notions of Christian thinking inside of my mind, even believing at the time I was agnostic or atheist or whatever it was I was exploring at the time. And I didn't like that. And so I think that I thought exploring Satanism was really interesting and really useful for deconstructing those notions and learning how to develop better self-worth and better boundaries with people. Because I think specifically in the United States too, or at least functioning under capitalism, people will always try to exploit you. And a lot of notions of Satanism are about like not letting people exploit you and trying to understand that. So that's why I like find Satanism interesting, and I will probably always write about it from that perspective and write about some of the like logical flaws and stuff that I find in Christianity. And not even from like a Richard Dawkins type perspective. It's more just like it's surprising how much Puritanism leaks into our culture, even for people who like aren't specifically religious, you know. So I think that's just wise. I guess I'm just always trying to identify Puritanism and like rip it out of people. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, no, I'm with you in terms of like even being agnostic or atheist or whatever I am now, but like growing up with these weird, like ingrained notions of, I mean, did you go through any sort of, were you raised Catholic? Like for me, I was baptized and communion and confirmation, and there's a lot of, you know, shame at every step of the way. So yeah. Was it like, were you raised that way, or was it, and then it was like a conscious choice to like refute it or challenge it with Satanism? Or is it just kind of like, is it even further ingrained? It's just like actually being born and raised in the United States, like our traditions and culture is such that.
So I think it's actually, yeah, like being born and raised in the United States. I was born in England actually, but,
oh, cool.
Like, and my mom is, a British Methodist, which is like a sect of Christianity. But she like was Methodist in name only. Like she is really important to like happen for me to be baptized as a Methodist, but like she doesn't go to church. If I ask her about it, she doesn't know why it's Methodism or why it's different, you know, from mm-hmm. other forms of like what or anything like that, other forms of Christianity. But my dad was, I think, raised Catholic, and he definitely was like obsessed with Jesus. Like we always watched like Left Behind movies when I was a kid, and like he showed me Jesus Christ Superstar, and he also had this like really hippie idea, like God was nature and all this kind of stuff, like these really like what he thought was rebellious ideas of Christianity because he was raised Catholic and that sort of thing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I was never like, we did go to church when I was little, but I was never like forced to when I was older or anything like that. But I do think being removed from it and still seeing how it affected me, even though I didn't grow up in a super fundamentalist environment, really made me see just like how ingrained it is in our culture, in our minds. Like even like the idea that the universe isn't a fallen state is something that affects like everyone, you know, like mm-hmm. in that sort of mentality. When I don't think the universe is in a fallen state, I think it's like, you know, it's like it's great. Like the universe exists, and it's, you know,
yeah, yeah.
It is what it is and all of that.
And our urges and desires for the most part are fine and not something to sweep under the rug and feel ashamed about. But unless
you... yeah, yeah, 100%. You know, yeah. Like I definitely think I struggle with that too, or the idea that pleasure seeking is wrong in any way, or that we shouldn't, like, one thing that I definitely suffer from is that, like, Protestant work ethic thing, because, like, my mom really is someone who will work herself to exhaustion, and I do that, and it's, like, I'm constantly arguing with myself about whether or not I should, like, take breaks, or just, like, relax and, like, literally do nothing, and, like, my mind is always, like, really busy and stuff, and so, I mean, I still think that that's, you know, like, it's fine to, like, do nothing. It's fine to not be productive. It's ingrained. It's in, you know, it's in capitalism itself, too.
That's a gnarly one, the Protestant work ethic. That gets us all under capitalism. Yeah. It's funny to think about with writing, though, too, right? Like, because, you know, this is something that we're doing for ourselves, and it's interesting to try to think outside of that zone when writing, like, to how can we be, you know, consistently productive in a meaningful way for ourselves as writers without, you know, wearing ourselves thin trying to produce to get results, I guess. Yeah. Which is, you know, just hard to navigate. But
yeah.
It is hard to navigate. I'm definitely one of those people that is like, yeah, I want to obsessively work on it. But I think it's also good to, like, recognize that, I don't know, like, I guess, like, at the end of the day, like, it feels, like, really, really important, but also at the end of the day, it's, like, just writing, like, it is art, it is a little bit, like, selfish, and I think that's okay, too, like, it's 100% okay to, like, be selfish about it, if that's, like, what you want to do, as long as you're not harming other people, you know?
Mm, totally.
Yeah, so in the story, there's this love triangle, and we have Matt, who's a, well, okay, first of all, I think it's very interesting, like, Colorado Springs is where you are now, and is that presumably where you were when you wrote the book?
No, I was away. I was in Denver when I wrote the book. But, like, I spent the majority of my teenage life here, yeah.
And so, from what I've heard, although I've never been to Colorado, it has a pretty teeming evangelical community, and I wonder, like, to what extent that affected your own life and also the views of the characters and animals.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's like 600 churches in Colorado Springs.
Damn.
And it's like not even, I mean, at the time it was maybe 300,000 people. I think it's like a lot bigger now because it's grown a lot. And we grew up with, like, Focus on the Family on the news every day, and whatever that dude's name is, Lou Dobbs, like, talking about it all the time. And we had, like, junior achievement in our schools, which I didn't actually realize was an evangelical thing. I'm pretty sure it was until
I've never heard of them or that. What is it? Yeah. Just like a group?
It was like, God, what was it? It was just like some program that they had in our schools where they would, like, teach us stuff probably about drugs, like how drugs are bad and that kind of thing. It was a bit like a DARE program, but I can't really remember, like, what else it was about because it's been so long. I should look it up. But, like, later on I learned that was like a Focus on the Family program, and I was like, how is that even in, like, our public schools?
You know? Yeah, right. But, right, yeah. I mean, the like, even just, like, in practice, and I'm from Ohio, so it is what it is, but it's not, I don't think it's like Colorado in terms of evangelicism, but even then I would have these experiences with, like, public school teachers preaching stuff. And I, you know, and I'm just kind of like, the church and state thing is lost on us, I believe. But yeah, so book takes place in Colorado Springs. And was there a part of you that wanted to, like, refute the evangelicism of Colorado by writing this book? Or was it just sort of a product of you having lived there?
It was probably like a little bit of both. Like, I do think, so, like, in my, like, next novel, I definitely think I was more intentional about writing specifically, like, about Satanism in that way. I think at the time, maybe I was just more, like, yeah, writing about it because of, like, having experience growing up in that environment, probably.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been a lot more intentional, like, recently, specifically with it and about Satanism in general. So.
Have you seen that documentary called Hail Satan?
No.
It's the story of the process of how they got a Baphomet statue on the Georgia State House or something.
I think that's the Temple of Satan. There's like Satanism is now so old, there are different Satanism that do occur.
I have a lot to learn.
Yeah, it's really interesting, actually. I haven't seen that, but I think that's really cool. I think that there was also a Baphomet in Little Rock when I was living in Arkansas at the time, and I'm sad because I didn't get to go see it.
Yeah. I was pretty interested. Liz and I were talking about Lilith, and to be honest, I didn't know. So Lilith is the name that the narrator is given by Matt, the Satanist tattoo artist, and his wife, or his girlfriend, who's a new mom, correct?
Yeah.
And it's just sort of this romantic, sexual three-way. But I actually didn't know of like the Jewish mythological version of Lilith. And I wanted to know first, like, I wanted to know how you heard about that and how it found its way into the book.
Yeah. So I guess the first time I ever heard the name Lilith was from like the Lilith Fair when I was younger, because I was like, why is it called that? You know, and I remember like reading and researching it. And it's one of those things where like when I learned about that as a story, I was like, how come they like never told us about this like in like Sunday school or whatever, you know, like I never, right. never heard any Christians talk about it at all. And so I found that honestly really compelling, especially about how Lilith was, you know, I guess like demonized and how different versions of her stories show her as kind of like this demon and that sort of thing. And the core like tenet of her actions was that she refused to bow. And I just find that like so fascinating, especially because in terms of what Christianity decided to include like in their mythos, they just erased it. Like it's just, they just mm-hmm. don't believe that it's there and they won't talk about it. You know what I mean? So yeah. I don't know. I just found that fascinating. So.
Yeah. And so from the little I've learned, I mean, from your book and reading a little bit online. So one of the, I mean, obviously she is Adam's wife before Eve.
Yeah.
Which again, as someone who's raised Catholic, obviously I never heard about that, but also that she comes from the earth and not the rib, which basically doesn't make her subservient to men as my priest would like everyone to have believed. And so in a way it's almost like she's an empowering figure.
Yeah.
But the way that Lilith is used in this book is like, how did Matt and Francis come across, like how did they decide on naming her Lilith? Like what was their rationale for the narrator becoming Lilith?
So in part, the reason why they named her was to kind of erase her own identity. But she also like willingly accepts that, which I also think is really important. It was important for me to demonstrate that this person still had agency and could still make these choices. And then in choosing the name, I guess one of the reasons why I chose it was because she's seen as like the first wife. So for the narrator, it's like she wants to be first, mm-hmm. right? Like she wants to be that first wife and she wants to be special. And so there's like a special kind of like cruelty in giving her that name, but like not really letting her even have that position or anything close to it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was one of the motivating factors.
Yeah, that's cool. I mean, the tension that you build in this is like ridiculous. And I mean, I'm excited for what's next. Are you allowed to talk about it?
Well, I don't want to talk about
it. Don't want to talk about it? Yeah. I know there's Satanism is involved in Colorado, and that's exciting enough for me.
Yeah. You know what, though? I'm like almost forgetting. I do have a short collection of stories coming out, though, in February. Yeah.
Nudes. I heard about Nudes. It's coming out. Okay, so it's coming out in February. And can you give us like some backstory?
What kind of backstory? Like
about yeah, that's a good question. There's a bunch of different stories in it.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, are these stories recent or have they been with you for a while?
I think it's like a little bit of both. Like some of them are older and some of them actually are older ones that I've like totally rewritten. Like some were like published and I was like, I hate this. So I just rewrote it how I wanted. And it's kind of like remixed. Like, you know, it's like a completely different story almost. Like some of the ones I've updated, which I'm really excited about. I really like the idea of saying, well, like, I know this story's been published, but fuck that. I'm just going to rewrite the reality of it and pretend it was always this good.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, so, that's interesting. Were they published on the internet?
Yeah, a couple of them.
Yeah.
So, like, they're still out there. And then a couple of stories that have not been published anywhere either. So, like, the title story is pretty long. So I'm, like, actually pretty excited to get that out in the world and just see how people respond to it. And
yeah. I'm excited, too. I mean, I'm, like, kind of new to your work, but I really love it.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Well, that's really cool. Thanks a lot for joining us and coming on. And
yeah, thank you. I appreciate that.
All right, everyone. That was Elton Ashe. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you next time.